Today on Maine Calling, the impact of recent Supreme Court decisions. The United States Supreme Court issued several major opinions this term, and the impact of some of them will be immediate. From money in elections to birthright citizenship, presidential power to transgender health, the decisions are far-reaching, and in some cases, they overturn long-held precedent. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with two professors. One is a constitutional law scholar, and the other, an authority on executive power. We'll get their reaction to these decisions and what they mean for people both here in Maine and for the nation at large. And we'll discuss the expanding use of the so-called shadow docket. Also, what did we learn about the role of the justices and the direction of the Roberts Court? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine. Now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The U.S. Supreme Court concluded a consequential session last week. Today, we're going to talk about some of those major decisions and what they mean for Maine and the nation. And we discuss the reputation of today's Supreme Court justices and how the makeup of the court affects the nation. Joining me for the hour, Dimitri Baum, who is a professor of law at the University of Maine School of Law, and Andrew Rudalevich, Thomas Brackett Reed, professor of government at Bowdoin College. We invite you to join the conversation. Is there a Supreme Court ruling you have questions about? Is there something you are thinking about when you're thinking about the future of the U.S. Supreme Court? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment to Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. And I'll start by asking sort of a big question, which is a lot of people have been watching this court with expectations of what they would do and what they would not do, the justices. Were you surprised in the end? I'll start with you, Andrew. Were the decisions what you expected them to be?
Hi, well, thanks for having me today. Yeah, on the whole, I guess they did come down along the lines that I would have predicted. Now, that's not necessarily that I think those are all correct, but the court has been signaling, you know, for a few years now, its feelings about things like presidential power and administrative law, its views certainly on voting rights and districting and congressional cases, its views on questions of civil liberties, the Second Amendment dramatically, of course, but there are First Amendment cases here too. Perhaps the biggest surprise in a way will, I'm sure, come to the birthright citizenship case. That seemed, I think, to a lot of observers, like a slam dunk, almost a 9-0 case. Now, of course, very little in this court could be 9-0, but the fact that it turned out to be 5-4 on the constitutional question, that was a surprise, and maybe we can talk more about that.
All right, and Professor Baum, Dimitri, what about you? Were there any surprises?
I agree with Andrew. I think most of the kind of big issues were fairly predicted, how they would come out, certainly on executive power questions in terms of the FTC and the Slaughter case. I think most people predicted that result.
Okay, FTC is Federal Trade Commission. Quick explain.
Federal Trade Commission. Yes. So this is a big question of removal powers. You know, can the president remove somebody from these administrative agencies that are supposed to be independent and Congress created to be independent without any cause? And for many years now, the court has been shifting towards giving the president, the executive, more power of removal without any kind of oversight. And so I think many of the decisions we saw this term were kind of predicted. The court has trended in this direction over many years. So no huge surprises, although, you know, maybe some are surprised that President Trump lost as many big executive power cases as he did. Certainly the tariffs case, birthright citizenship case, the Federal Reserve case. So maybe a few more losses for the president than some had predicted.
All right. Well, since we're talking so much about executive power right now, let's talk about that a little bit more deeply.
Andrew Dimitri mentioned three cases in which the president lost. I'm going to ask you to expand that in case expand upon that in case our listeners are not following these stories as closely as you all are. The tariffs case that was earlier in the term. What did the court decide, and how serious a blow was that to the president?
Well, so that was a case that actually was decided in February. It came out of the president's imposition of tariffs unilaterally, at a whim, one might say, taking them on, raising them, lowering them, removing them, based on his claimed powers under something called the International Economic Emergency Powers Act, which is always abbreviated IEPA, because it's impossible to say fast otherwise. And so IEPA doesn't talk about tariffs. It is the basis for how presidents impose emergency financial sanctions on countries and individuals. And it does grapple with questions of international trade, I guess. So the Trump administration decided that they had enough power under that law to, again, basically manipulate tariffs on a daily, minute-by-minute basis. The Supreme Court disagreed with that. They said that the substance of the law did not go that far, that Congress has the taxing power, and tariffs, after all, are a tax. And so without a clearer declaration by Congress that they were delegating that power to the president, that that couldn't stand. So there were different arguments in the majority there as to why this law didn't help the president do what he wanted to do, but on the whole, broad-ish agreement that the president had overstepped.
And let me turn to you, Dimitri. When there are different arguments in the majority, what does that mean for the next time there is a tariff case before the Supreme Court?
Well, certainly the president came back and tried to reimplement some of the tariffs under different statutes that may have, you know, kind of different schemes, right? But ultimately, the court's core holding is more deferential to Congress, right? If Congress wants to give away such a broad power as to issue tariffs, it needs to be more clear in doing so. And I think the really important piece here is, you know, we had a streak of losses by President Biden on this kind of similar question, on the what the court has termed the major questions doctrine, right? So President Biden tried to cancel student loans or issue certain mask mandates. The president lost. So the big critique of the court was the court created this doctrine in order to minimize a Democratic president's power. So I think the most important piece of the tariffs case is actually more structural in a sense, that now you have the court using the same doctrine, the major questions doctrine, to strike down a core agenda item for a Republican president. And so now, to the extent you take that doctrine seriously, it does give, you know, shift some power toward Congress, or at least maybe will force Congress to be a little more clear in the statutes that it writes. If it wants to delegate some authority, it needs to say it explicitly rather than trusting the president to basically rule by executive order.
It's interesting because Andrew Dimitri just said putting more of the power into Congress, but many of the decisions put more of the power this session with the president.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, it's true that the court has sort of demanded that Congress be more specific, but I would suggest, too, the court is giving itself a lot of discretionary authority here to decide, is this a major question or not? There doesn't seem to be any real decision rule that they've built into this doctrine. Doctrine is a kind word for making up as you go along, I think, in some aspects of court jurisprudence. And so, you know, we'll see, right, how consistent they are over time. This one, in a way, again, was an easy one in that, you know, this is a big case with billions, perhaps trillions of dollars at stake. So clearly major. And again, one where the statute didn't go to the president's favor. But as you say, a lot of these cases have come down in favor of presidential power. Dimitri talked earlier about removal, right? And this has been an issue, you know, for a long time, you know, arguably to the first Congress in 1789, about how the power to fire people, especially those who had been confirmed by the Senate, should flow. Should the president be able to fire people unilaterally, even if they were confirmed? Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers actually said, no, actually, since the Senate has to confirm them, Senate has to help remove them. But that's not an argument that stuck over time. And so, you know, we've had really 100 years of sort of thinking about this at the Supreme Court level. Courts gone back and forth. As of 1935, it had sort of settled on the idea that the president could fire people who were sort of directly below him in authority, but the Congress had a lot of authority in its own right to buffer certain agencies and certain personnel from the president, that you could create a regulatory commission like the FTC. And in fact, the really key case here is from 1935 about the FTC itself that says, yeah, if you have a regulatory commission, it's not doing purely executive things. It's not in a direct line of authority to the president. You could have fixed terms, or you could have a protection of the members of the regulatory commission, that they could only be fired for cause instead of because the president felt like it. So the 1935 case actually was an FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, came into office and he wanted to put his own people in. So he fires this guy, William Humphrey, on the Federal Trade Commission. The Supreme Court a couple years later says, no, you can't do that. So, you know, when President Trump comes in 2025, he does basically exactly the same thing. You know, he says to the Democratic appointees on the FTC, we have different plans, different priorities, and you're gone. Now, because of the Supreme Court precedent from 1935, the commissioner is fired. Ms. Slaughter, Rebecca Slaughter specifically, you know, they had a pretty good case, right? The statute says you can only be fired for cause. The Supreme Court said that's fine. But Dimitri mentioned earlier, court has been signaling for a while that it's pretty interested in expanding executive power in this regard. It's part of the unitary executive theory that we can talk more about. And, you know, they basically wrote regulatory commissions in terms of at least their protected status, buffering from political interference, out of existence in this decision. So that's a pretty big win for the president. President Trump went on social media and said the biggest win for presidential power in 100 years. I'm not sure about that. But it is part and parcel, again, of earlier cases and notably of the criminal immunity decision that was put down in 2024, which, again, gives presidents a lot of inherent executive authority that isn't necessarily clear from the Constitution and certainly not from American history.
Dimitri.
I'd say one of the more interesting things as well on this point is on the same day, they also decided the Cook case, which is about the Federal Reserve, which is another independent agency. And there the court says, well, the Federal Reserve is different. We don't know for sure why, right? It has a different history, you know, it's created for different purposes. But for the Federal Reserve, and we'll see next year, maybe administrative law judges, maybe some other positions, it's not a unitary executive, right? So Slaughter, I think, is important, establishes a baseline rule that the president can fire people at will that are within the executive branch, that are serving executive functions. But there seem to be some exceptions. The Federal Reserve is apparently one of those exceptions, and there may be others as well. So the court's not willing to go full executive power, unitary executive theory quite yet.
If I could just add to that, the dissenters in the Cook case, the Fed case, basically said, hey, look, you just put down this, the logic of the decision you just endorsed, Chief Justice Roberts, says it should apply to the Fed. What's the logical difference? And he struggles, I have to say, to come up with one. There's also questions, right? So what executive agencies are going to be sort of able to be buffered? And also, how about those officers in the federal government who are not appointed directly by the president and confirmed by the Senate? There are a lot of those. And there are cases about whether the president can fire civil servants, despite the fact that they, too, often have job protections.
Joining us now, Gia Drew, who is Executive Director of Equality Maine. Thanks for calling in, Gia.
Hey, Jen. Glad to be here. Thank you.
I know that you've been watching the courts on several issues, and some of those issues were on the Supreme Court docket this year. Some decisions were made, and some are still expected in the future. But I'd like to start with the most recent ruling regarding states that ban transgender girls from participating in sports. Were you surprised by that decision?
You know, I don't think so. You know, along with our counterparts across the country, this was kind of telegraphed since the hearing earlier. But, you know, they could have gone further, and which is, we're thankful they didn't go further. And it does say that states can ban based on sex in terms of sports, but they also allow states to allow transgender students to participate in sports. So the states like Maine that do allow trans girls and women to play sports are allowed to continue doing this, but it also sends a message that states who are banning them can continue to discriminate. And that is sends a really harmful message to kids and girls, especially trans kids and girls.
All right. Another decision that I don't believe, unless you correct me, affects Maine directly is the decision about conversion therapy. That decision 8-1 that says that states cannot ban conversion therapy. How does that impact Maine?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I remember listening to this argument, and it really came down to the free speech rights of this one petitioner in Colorado. Colorado had a conversion therapy ban. A therapist, yes. And, you know, it got sent back to Colorado to the lower court so they could reassess how they regulate conversion therapy. And I think that's one thing we're looking at here, or one of those 19 or 20 states that have bans on conversion therapy, which is a dangerous practice that is discredited by all the national organizations on mental health. And so we have to look at what our looks like to see if we have to tighten it up or make any adjustments in the next legislative session. And so while it doesn't, directly affect conversion therapy, it does, affect the way we regulate it. And so that's concerning, but I think we're hopeful here in Maine that our law will stay intact.
Another case in California was about parents being notified if their child at school is transitioning from one gender to another. Tell us what the issue was there and why the decision came down where it was, or what your understanding of that is.
I'm actually following a different case because I know they ruled on a couple, the court ruled on a couple of cases and actually said they weren't going to take up one. And the one I've been paying attention to is the one in the First Circuit, which is Massachusetts, where they left in place the ability to schools to protect the privacy of their students. I don't think the Supreme Court took this up completely across the nation in terms of how much parents can know or not know and how it's connected to FERPA, which is a regulation on federally information around education that parents are allowed to know. And so I'm hopeful that, students have a right to some privacy while they're at school related to their own identity and who they are. And it's different if you're talking about school records, like grades and things like that. And so from what I know, the Supreme Court said Massachusetts can leave in place protections for students, and I'm unfamiliar with the California case.
Okay. I just wanted to ask you sort of this broader question, Gia, as we see states that have one set of laws and other states with another set of laws when it, comes to whether it's transgender students or conversion therapy. And I'm wondering if you foresee people moving to states like Maine from states where the laws are different.
They already are. Yeah, Jen, they already are. Unfortunately, because of the so many states, 20 to 25 states have either, made it illegal to access gender affirming care if you're a minor. I know many young people and their families are navigating across the country to get that care and then going back to where they live. And there definitely been influx of folks looking for protections and peaceful living and jobs in states that are more affirming of themselves and their families. And Maine is one of those places for sure. But the downside is, we have limited resources here too. And so I have noticed people looking to move to blue states or more protective states for transgender people. I've also heard of folks, leaving the country and trying to find somewhere else to go so they can feel safe and feel protected to live their lives as they see fit. And so definitely been some movement. I know there's some different tracking tools about how many thousands of transgender people and their families have moved, but that is disheartening. We do think that people shouldn't have to move to be themselves, but that's just the way our country is right now. And I hope this doesn't last. I hope we get through this and we can kind of turn the tides around in the future.
And Gia, what are you watching for next term with the Supreme Court? What are the major issues that you're tracking? Oh, I think I might have lost Gia. That was Gia Drew with Equality Maine. We will take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What are the impacts of recent Supreme Court rulings, and does the general public view the justices is too political. My guest today, Andy Rudalevich, who's professor of government at Bowdoin College, and Dimitri Baum, who is a professor of law at the UMaine School of Law. You can join the conversation with a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before the break, we lost Gia Drew. Gia's back. And Gia, I just wanted to ask you what cases you're really paying attention to for the next term of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, thanks, Jen. Sorry about that drop. You know, I think we're concerned about the cases related to transgender people who are incarcerated. I think there's probably going to be a case coming up. And then there's ongoing conversation related to transgender people serving in the military. So we're watching that. And I don't know if there'll be more cases related to agency decisions related to gender affirming care and healthcare related things related to Medicaid and Medicare and things like that. And so we're watching, you know, and unfortunately, you know, elections have consequences, and the president has been able to put very conservative justices on the court. And I'm hopeful in a couple of years we'll be able to turn this ship around and we can go in a different direction. But we are paying attention. It seems like people are really concerned about their rights to be themselves, especially LGBTQ people.
Gia, thank you for calling and calling back. Gia Drew with Equality Maine. I'm going to go to really great questions from our audience members that are already coming in on email. This is from W. Allen. How is it possible that three justices were willing to disregard the very clear text of the 14th Amendment and declare that some babies born in the U.S. are not U.S. citizens? So, Dimitri, let's turn to you. We've sort of very briefly brought this up. He's talking about the birthright citizenship case. One of you used the expression that people thought it was going to be a slam dunk and perhaps a 9-0 decision. How come it was not?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question. I think most of the predictions that I saw early on in the betting markets were, you know, maybe 9-0, maybe 7-2 at most. Maybe Justice Thomas and Justice Alito were thought to be kind of available votes. I mean, the case comes down to the question of what does jurisdiction thereof mean, right? So everyone agrees, all right, born in the United States, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, what does that phrase mean? For many, many decades, centuries, it's really been thought to mean exclude a very narrow group of people, right? So, you know, people who are here from overseas, you know, invading armies, right? So very, very small group of people. The question does that have a broader meaning? And there's been a push, kind of a grassroots movement to suggest that kind of the best reading of that phrase focus on domicile and the kind of the intent to stay in the United States, allegiance to foreign nations. And that seems to have kind of gone from an off-the-wall argument that I think at first was almost treated as frivolous to being accepted that maybe such jurisdiction thereof has a broader meaning than it has sort of been thought to have, right? And so there's at least three justices and maybe four that believe that subject to jurisdiction thereof is broader than we might have thought.
Hmm. Well, joining us now is Lisa Parisio, who is policy director with the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project. Thanks for calling in, Lisa.
Thanks, Jennifer.
As you just heard, we have talked a little bit about the ruling on birthright citizenship. But before I ask you about some other rulings, I want to see if there's anything you wanted to add to that.
No, I certainly applaud the incredible work of the organizations in Maine and all the plaintiffs that brought that case. What an incredible outcome for, protecting the constitutional rights of all of us.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the other earlier this term. There was a decision about asylum seekers. So many of the people who are here in Maine waiting for that big court date are indeed asylum seekers. How does what the court decided affect them?
So in the asylum case, the Supreme Court was looking at the definition of what it means to arrive in the United States. So, you know, under our asylum law, that's the language. You know, people must either be in the United States or arrive in the United States to, you know, seek their right to asylum and seek protection from persecution. So this case really had to do with policies that have existed at the southern border. And, you know, there have been various iterations of policy and practices that essentially block people from asking for asylum at ports of entry by making them, you know, physically wait in Mexico and turning them back from seeking protection. So this was the question that was before the court in this case. You know, is it permissible for a border agent to prevent you from setting foot on U.S. soil and then say, because you're not on U.S. soil, you can't apply for asylum, you can't seek your right to seek asylum? And the court said yes in this case, that is permissible. So, you know, this is a huge gutting of our existing asylum law, existing asylum protections. And, you know, the outcomes of this case are completely foreseeable, you know, because some of these policies have been in place. We know that when people are not allowed to seek their right to asylum in the United States and are forced to wait in Mexico, people are put in even more dangerous situations. Extortion, kidnapping, violent assault, sexual assault, even murder are very well documented. So this is a huge blow for our asylum law, our longstanding law and humanitarian protection. And has really devastating consequences for people who have nowhere else to turn, people who have been forced to seek asylum and are looking for safety here in the United States.
And then what about the court's ruling on temporary protected status? What did the decision say and how could it affect people who are already here?
Mm-hmm. I think like the asylum case, the decision on temporary protected status, you know, as your guests have been talking about today, really expanded presidential power and executive power. And in this case, you know, really allows them in the Trump administration to further what is, you know, unfortunately a political agenda when it comes to humanitarian immigration protection, which certainly should never be a political issue. In the TPS case, essentially the Supreme Court found that TPS decisions are not reviewable by the courts. And under the law, you know, TPS decisions must be based on country conditions. What TPS is it is a blanket designation for a country that safeguards people who are already in the United States if something catastrophic has happened in their home country that prevents them from safely returning. So under the law, the, you know, Secretary of Homeland Security is supposed to look at country conditions in consultation with the State Department and other experts in the government. So what this decision says, what this decision does, is it empowers this administration and future administrations to make TPS decisions that are not based on country conditions, that are outside the bounds of the law that Congress designed, which, of course, is what we've been seeing and why these cases, why this case was brought forward in the first place. So this has immediate implications for people here in Maine and all across the country. The two countries that brought this case were TPS holders from Haiti and Syria. You know, people who have been in the United States for many, many years under this protection have been raising families in the workforce. We estimate that there are at least hundreds of people here in Maine who are initially impacted by the decisions on TPS for Haiti and Syria, and then upwards of 700 TPS holders total that that may be affected, that will be affected by this decision. So, you know, what that means, again, is people who have been living here under the law have, you know, paid fees, have given all of their information to the government, are well-rooted in communities, raising families here, are at risk of suddenly losing protection. And really quickly, I just want to note that in the wake of this, you know, disaster that has been created by the Supreme Court decision, there is a bill that is in the Senate right now that would designate TPS for Haiti and protect those hundreds of people here in Maine and across the country. It is already through the House and it is in the Senate right now. Senator King is a co-sponsor. So people who are concerned about this decision and protecting people who are at the most immediate risk should certainly raise their voices on this really important piece of legislation.
Lisa, since we have you on the phone, I want to ask you, I have heard that there is an increase in immigration enforcement, ICE enforcement recently in Maine. Is that true? Is that what you are seeing? And what are you hearing about the presence of ICE agents?
Sure. I think that we are continuing to see an uptick in ICE presence here in Maine. And I think the most important thing for everyone in the state to know is, you know, after the January operation, enforcement didn't end at that moment. You know, enforcement has been going on every single day in our state. At ILAP, you know, we're the only statewide immigration legal services organization, so we are seeing people arrested every single day. Some of the, you know, changes that we're seeing in enforcement, we are seeing a lot of people targeted around their homes, you know, people that are getting in their cars, heading to work, just getting home from work. But otherwise, you know, patterns have not changed. You know, again, the majority of people who are being picked up are people who are following lawful statuses, have absolutely no criminal record. And, you know, the way that the Supreme Court decision on TPS is really interconnected with this question is, you know, through this TPS decision, you know, the administration is going to actually be able to strip away lawful status from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people here in Maine. You know, and that is why they are, you know, seeking to terminate TPS. They are trying to increase the number of people that they can deport, that they can go after. So there are, you know, serious risks for people who have TPS in Maine and across the country. And again, you know, Congress really needs to step in and address this crisis that has been created.
Lisa, thank you for calling in. Lisa Parisio with the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, which is also known as ILAP. So many emails coming in. Let's see here. Try to get to as many as possible. Here's an email from Tony. Is the use of the shadow docket based in law, rule, or the Constitution? Its use undermines the legitimacy of the court. Dimitri, we hear this phrase, the shadow docket. What does that mean? I have read that the court is using it more. Can you explain this to us?
Yeah, so a shadow docket is a term that's been kind of created for the interim decisions, right? So there's a decision of the lower court, or maybe of the state court, that decides a case one way or the other. And the case is being appealed to the Supreme Court. Something has to happen while the case is being appealed. And the question is, what happens during that time? And so the court will often take these cases, we can call it emergency docket or interim docket or shadow docket, which sounds more menacing in some ways. But it is based in rule in a sense, because the court can decide to stay a lower court decision, or it can decide to continue it, right? So it kind of decides what the status quo is. There are court rules that set up procedures for what happens in those situations. They just haven't been used as much historically as they're being used now, where the court basically has said almost everything is an emergency, right? So the government loses a case almost every time it's appealed. The court says, yeah, we've got to reverse the lower court while the case is being appealed. And the critique, of course, is that those cases are being decided, even though temporarily, without briefing, without oral argument, and oftentimes without any kind of a written opinion. So to the extent you care about transparency or openness, you're not seeing a lot of that in these temporary cases. But it's not kind of a novel invention of the court. It's something that has existed, just has been being used a lot more often these days.
Anything to add, Andrew?
Yeah, just to say that the use by administrations of appeals to the court to, you know, impose these kinds of rulings has risen quite dramatically. One scholar, for example, looked back and found that in the, you know, 16 years of the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations, there were 8 requests by the administration, you know, through the Justice Department for these kinds of rulings. In the first Trump administration, there were 41. That went down a little bit, a lot under Biden, 19, so still higher than usual, but now we're up to 35 plus just in the year plus that President Trump has been back in office. So it's definitely a tactic that they've used quite frequently. And we see it, you know, the court has to decide whether, you know, for example, when the president has fired someone or a lot of people, you know, where is the damage done? You know, should there be an injunction against the firing until the merits of the case are heard, or should the firing go ahead? And then, of course, in principle, the people could be hired back. But in practice, of course, you know, once you've gotten rid of a whole bunch of people from an agency or dismantled the agency entirely, you know, Humpty Dumpty-like, you're not going to be able to put that agency or staff back together again. So in practical terms, you know, the court deciding that the real harm here is to the administration not being able to carry out its wishes seems a little backwards, I think, to a lot of folks.
We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, and especially this past term. What are your questions or comments? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. From executive power to voting rights to birthright citizenship, how are Supreme Court decisions affecting controversial national issues? Joining me for this hour, Dimitri Baum, who is a professor at Maine Law, and Andy Rudalevich, who is a professor at Bowdoin. He's a government professor. Share your comments and questions. If you're quick, you can send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Jan. Do you think Trump will have the opportunity to appoint another Supreme Court justice before his term expires? If so, what would be the impact of the Republicans retaining control of the Senate versus the Democrats taking control after the midterms? Andy.
Well, that's a big maybe, I think. It really depends on what the justices decide to do. And of course, it could depend on random and unexpected health issues as well. Remember, 10 years ago, Justice Scalia died very unexpectedly, without any sort of expectation that that was going to happen. That doesn't seem to be the case with members of the current court, but the listener may be referring to the rumors about Justice Alito, whose departure is being discussed in the context really of a strategic retirement, right? To be able, in fact, to give President Trump a nominee to the court, a much younger nominee, presumably, who would be there for a lifetime under good behavior, and then who would, would circumvent the possibility of Democrats taking majority control of the Senate in 2027, because you would have you'd rush probably to fill that vacancy before any party control took place. You know, in the old days, the basic rule was, you know, if you got lucky enough to get an appointment, then you made that appointment, and whatever formulation, whatever configuration, partisan-wise, of the Senate existed, they would deal with it. But of course, after the Scalia death, that was something the Senate just refused to do. They refused to hear. Conduct hearings on President Obama's nominee to succeed Justice Scalia. So now we're sort of in the, a world where, you know, if you have a Senate of your party, you have a chance of getting someone confirmed. We don't know yet how long a party opposite to the president would dare to delay, but maybe a long, long time. So, you know, there is some impetus in terms of thinking strategically for the parties. And of course, this does imply, and I fear we need to go there, that the seats are partisan in a serious sense. This is something that Justice Alito is probably thinking of. Maybe he's thinking of Justice Ginsburg, who did not retire, even though she was very ill and quite old. And her seat then was filled by President Trump and not by President Obama.
Well, let me ask you this, Andy, because a lot of people are talking about what the strategy ought to be for either party. And I'm wondering if that were to happen, if President Trump were to get a nominee at this point, this year, before the election, is the fact that at least a couple Republican senators are in tight races, would that impact who he appoints?
Perhaps. Yeah, I mean, in the first term, President Trump had sort of a list from the Federalist Society. Then back in 2016, he had promised to appoint people from a particular list in order to convince conservatives that he indeed was conservative. Of course, his past record was not necessarily reassuring in that regard. He kept that promise, right? And along with the majority leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, they did a very active job in filling vacancies as quickly as possible. He's sort of fallen out, you know, with the Federalist Society over time. And so, you know, some of the folks he has appointed have been far more sort of traditionally partisan than that first list of conservative, but certainly, sort of mainstream constitutionalists in a lot of ways, jurists. So we will see, I guess, whether the president wants to push his point, see if he can get someone extreme through, even with a narrow majority in the Senate, or whether he would hew to what would be the conventional political wisdom, which would be to You know, it would be someone with a sort of conservative background, but not necessarily a firebrand, right? That would be the good political advice. President Trump heeds his own advice, I suspect.
Dimitri, I want to ask you about the reputation of the Supreme Court. I'm looking right here at a Gallup poll saying that the Supreme Court approval rating has reached its lowest point since they started asking this question 26 years ago at 39%. Does it matter what the public thinks of the Supreme Court? And if so, or if not, why or why not?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom is that it does matter, right? So we go back to the Federalist Papers, we talk about how the court is the maybe the least dangerous branch, but it's the least powerful branch. It doesn't have the power of the purse or of the sword, right? So it relies on the public confidence and respect for its decisions. When the court says something, people follow their decision, even if they disagree with it. And so if you have such a low respect for the court, perhaps that endangers the reputation of the court and the rule of law itself. Right. But, you know, I think somewhat ties to Andy's points earlier. There is this historical wisdom that the court is nonpartisan. It's an apolitical branch of government. And I think it's hard to pretend that's the case anymore, given the process for appointments, given strategic retirements. And I think people are seeing more and more that whoever the president is, they can pick people who are ideologically aligned with their views. And we're seeing more and more decisions, especially in the big, important cases, that are divided among party lines, right? The party of the president who appointed them, the six justices, they're united, and the three dissenting liberal justices are united. And so I think the public is seeing more and more of that, and I think it's hard to pretend that the court is somehow apolitical, whereas, you know, the executive branch and the legislative branches are purely partisan.
Andrew.
Just to note the comment of one important observer back in March of 2026, this person said that the court was, quote, little more than a weaponized and unjust political organization, unquote. Of course, that was President Trump talking about the court. So, you know, people like it as a political organization or rules in their favor, not so much when it rules against.
We'll go to Jim calling from Bangor. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer, and I appreciate your wonderful guest today. I'm calling with regard to the Supreme Court's recent decision in Calais v. Louisiana, in which Justice Samuel Alito faced heavy criticism for citing and relying upon misleading and what critics have called cherry-picked voting statistics in gutting the Voting Rights Act. Also, I'd be interested in our guest's observations regarding, it seems, to be a series of outcome-oriented decisions by the majority of this court. Historically, the justices have favored state rights and original as conservatives, but when an outcome that is desired by conservatives and ignores states' rights or original intent, they say they come out with the political end that they desire. And finally, this seems to be a unique court because there's no centrist, really, at least among the majority conservative Republican-appointed judges. We've been very fortunate in history to have some wonderful judges like Justice Stevens, who has been in the middle and seemed to be objective instead of political. I'm interested in your comments. Thank you.
I'll go back to you, Andy.
Sure. So the Calais case, two L's, shout out to our listeners in Calais. This was about the Voting Rights Act and how states had to use its provisions about redistricting to protect or not protect racial minorities. There's a lot of congressional statute, 1982, for example, Congress demanded that votes not be diluted. And so that different groups had the chance equally to vote for their preferred members, Congress or state legislature and so on. And that turned into the creation of majority-minority districts. And that has been quite controversial over time, but certainly did boost the census of Black, Latino, other lawmakers in Congress. And so, you know, the court now is ruling that, in fact, this dilution piece isn't as important. You know, as long as the state can come up with a reason that is not racial but partisan for making a redistricting decision, that's fine. And so, you know, here's the issue that the caller, I think, referred to. You know, Justice Alito, in his opinion, wanted someone bringing a suit against the state to be able to say, you know, this was purely racial, not partisan. But of course, you know, racial groups in the United States vote pretty heavily along different partisan lines. And so it's very hard to control for the outcome, you know, say this was purely racial and not partisan when, you know, so many percentage, for example, of Black voters are voting for the Democratic Party. And so if that's the case, right, I mean, I think Justice Alito would do well to take a basic statistics course about how you control for these factors. I'm not expecting that, but it does make it very difficult for courts to look at any redistricting commission decision and say, well, this was racially oriented. I'd note in passing, you know, that the, you know, the TPS case that was mentioned earlier, lower courts also found a racial component to some of that. That was dismissed pretty much out of hand, again, by Justice Alito. And, you know, if you look back to the question about college admissions a couple terms ago, there was a case where the court said, well, if even if you have other reasons to admit the student, if you're thinking about race, you can't do it. They did the opposite in the voting rights case. They said, you know, if there's anything else you can come up with that's not race, then it's fine.
Mm, yeah, and some people have pointed out the irony of that. Dimitri, anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think the court has become very skeptical of any kind of effects-based test, right? And so in the Voting Rights Act, where the court had said the Constitution requires an intent to discriminate, Congress came back and said, no, effects alone are enough. If you have, you know, 2 out of 6 districts in Louisiana are primarily African-American, you should be getting about 1/3 of the seats. And the court has over the years has kind of shifted away from that effects-based test, really focusing on intent and requiring plaintiffs to show intent in these cases. One really unfortunate piece of, in the cases that Andy mentioned is, you know, in the early cases on partisan gerrymandering, the court seemed very suspicious of partisan gerrymandering, kind of said, well, we can't do anything about it because we don't know what the baseline is, so we have to live with it. Whereas the way Calais is written, it almost kind of extols the virtues of partisan gerrymandering, that we want to kind of encourage states to do that. And so if they're doing that and not racial gerrymandering, that's okay. And I think that's kind of a shift in the way the court, in how the court talks about partisan gerrymandering, which I think is a major problem.
Mm. Jim, thanks for your call. We just have a couple minutes left, and it occurs to me we have not yet talked about the campaign spending decision. And Andy, one of the reasons I think that's important to talk about here in Maine is that we're already seeing record amounts of money spent in Maine for both our, well, especially the U.S. Senate race, but also the 2nd Congressional District and the governor's race. Is this going to make it even more obscene?
Well, the decision, again, is one in a long line of decisions really casting campaign donations and spending as a First Amendment right. That money is speech, and therefore to limit money in campaigning is to limit speech, and that has to have a very high bar. And the bar has normally been, well, that could be corrupting if you're giving that much money to a campaign. Of course, as we've moved through, you know, the now 50 years since the Federal Election Campaign Act's the first major case, Buckley v. Valeo, we've seen the court, you know, more and more generous towards protected speech, in this case, protected money. And of course, Citizens United and related cases at the lower court levels have really opened up the ability of unions and corporations and so-called super PACs to work their will, often without disclosure of donors. What the current case does is to take away the limit of state political parties in their contribution to different candidates. So before, they weren't really allowed to coordinate with candidates over a certain level of donation. Now they can. So I guess the bad news is, I suppose, this is another route for unlimited money to come into campaigns. And as you say, there's going to be plenty of it in Maine this fall. The good side is I tend to think of the political parties as more responsible than the super PACs and the undisclosed dark money groups that are pumping that same money already into campaigns. And so I'm not as critical of this case, actually, because I think the parties, to the degree they can be strengthened, ought to be.
All right. Well, that's going to be the final word. Really appreciate you all bringing your analysis to Maine Calling today. That was Andy Rudalevich, who is a professor of government at Bowdoin College, and Dimitri Baum, a professor of law at the UMaine School of Law. Today's sound engineer was Jess Miller. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the controversy over antidepressant medications. How prevalent are they? What are their potential benefits and harms, and why is the health secretary targeting them? I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.